Hi, everyone, and welcome to this next episode of the All In Sustainable Business Podcast. The recording of this one is a bit different than usual in that you often hear me, and this is Mark Lee, one of your regular hosts, saying I'm in California today, and Chris Coulter, who I'm here with today, is often posted up at home in Ontario, Canada. And then, of course, David Grayson, our third co-host, lives in London and spends some of his time in Spain and other parts of the world doing his work as well. But in this instance, it's just Chris and I. And the two of us are both in New York. We're, you know, middle end of Climate Week 2025. We're sitting in the ERM offices, kind of midtown, got a view of Grand Central. And actually, the fact that we're kind of in the middle of the city and what we can see, and anytime you look out in New York, you see a lot all at once. It fills the eye. A bit of a metaphor there, I think, for Climate Week. We've been deep in the agenda and in all that's been happening here this week for the last few days. And there's been this incredible diversity and amount of information and activity and conversation. So in the same way that the New York skyline fills the eye, I think, Chris, my ears, my mind, everything, maybe my soul, who knows, have been topped up by being here this week. So we wanted to bring you almost a postcard from New York and just talk a bit on reflections of what this year's Climate Week has been. And Chris, maybe we can kick it off with just a very broad question to you. About the tone you've picked up here this week and how it maybe compares to other years you've attended.
Yeah, so it's nice to be in person. That's rare.
Very.
You can slap me physically if I'm going out beast. But I guess thinking of it even before Climate Week kicked off and a couple of months ago, almost like what's it going to be like? What do we expect? I think there's lots of uncertainty. Would it be a full-on Climate Week? Would it be the same kind of energy? And I guess now on reflection, it's as busy as ever. It feels as energetic as ever. I think it's surprisingly more optimistic than I thought, and people are looking to try and make the best of the situation, understand the situation, and then, you know, what next? What do we do? Mm-hmm. So there's good. There's good energy, good perspective, and lots of stuff going on as every Climate Week. So it's a little exhausting too, you know, running around the city and trying to not be too late for events and for meetings. But it's been really good fun. But now with Wednesday, I'm tired.
Yeah. It feels like the week seems very concentrated in some ways. To the front end with the overlap with the UN General Assembly, I think there's genuinely more people here until Wednesday, Thursday, and then it starts to kind of arc down towards the end of the week. I've had a similar experience and feeling as you, I think, Chris, that I truly wasn't sure what this year's Climate Week would bring. There's obviously a lot going on in the world. Some of that is political turmoil. Some of that is real genuine political tension. And wondered what we do know. You know, some companies decided not to send their delegations to New York this year. And part of that was tied up in trade and geopolitics and everything else. But a record number of people are here. And it seems by reports that it is, again, a record number of official kind of registered Climate Week events, more than 1,000. And who knows how many unofficial, on the sidelines, convenings, discussions, you know, skunk works, people trying to find ideas. So it's been very energizing, very interesting, incredible diversity of people here. One of the things we've talked about recently on the podcast, Chris, and it ties to what we did here this week, is the sustainability at a crossroads research that we did. Yep. We GlobeScan, ERM, and Volans that we released in the early summer. And for anybody who hasn't heard us talk about this before, I'll try and do this really quick. So we did a global survey, 844 folks, 72 countries, highly qualified sustainability experts. And this was to take the pulse on the state of the sustainability agenda here in 2025. And that was partly thinking about what a milestone 2030 represents in many ways, kind of on the path to the low carbon economy we're supposed to deliver by mid-century. Big, big, big ambitions, and a sense that here in 2025, not getting it done, right? We're not adequately on track. And if I tried to bring the survey together in 60 seconds, we asked people, how do you personally feel about the state of the sustainability agenda? And 93% said we need to change it. And 56% said we need to change it a lot, like asked for radical change. they layered on to that, that we are needing to do that at a time when perceptions of backlash and the impacts of backlash on the sustainability agenda are more global than they have ever been, and just bigger than they have ever been. So what used to be seen as a significant but kind of primarily US problem is now perceived by 70%, I think it was, of experts said they're feeling it in all parts of the world except APAC. And I think we'll come back to that. But there's a different feeling, maybe more optimistic, unencumbered, out in the Asia Pacific region than anywhere else. Third part to go with that call for change and backlash is that we're sitting in a moment where institutional trust or confidence in government, the private sector, the UN, civil society, NGOs, in anyone basically but academia and scientists is low generally, and maybe more importantly, it's lower than it's been since we started tracking this question in around 2012. So all these organizations are being asked to help lead a huge change, like decarbonize the economy, folks. And by the way, do it in the just transition way that takes care of people and communities and nature at the same time. But we don't have great confidence in you, and the policy environment is tough. So I think that colored a number of the conversations we were part of. It reflects the complexity of the whole agenda here. But we also had a focused session on that on Tuesday of this week. And Chris, maybe you can talk a bit about how people responded to the research in that conversation. And maybe we could build out to some of the solutions that are in the survey and how we did or didn't see those on the Climate Week agenda.
Yeah, the workshop was amazingly interactive. Like almost every person in the room spoke and spoke
multiple times
in a material way, right? And I think the way, this is not because we did an amazing job, but I think the research seems to have just been framed in the right way. Luckily, you know, a broken clock is right twice a day. But
here I thought we did a pretty good job.
I mean, sometimes we've done a good job, but it hasn't had the same traction. So
I agree.
So why is this so resonant?
Yeah.
And I think it does set it up. And we saw this yesterday too. It almost, we need in the sustainable world, we need a little bit of a moment to say, wow, things are tough. Like we need a little doom and gloom, a little sense that we're up against, that there's some headwinds. And then once that's out of the system, we can have a conversation about what next. I think that to me, it's very simple, but I think that kind of learning of like, let's be optimistic, let's jump into solutions, what are we going to do? It bubbles up and kind of almost infects or contaminates the flow in some ways. Like as the research, as you just laid out, says, all right, people are unsatisfied, and it means change, right? Dissatisfaction, status quo, whoever is doing what they're doing, they're not doing it well enough. We've got these headwinds. So, okay, now what? What's next? And that feels like it lifts some of the weight off the shoulders, and then people are able to participate in the solutions.
Yeah, and it was interesting watching all of those things get expressed by the people who were in the room with us on the conversation this week, that we had these moments of real hope and optimism and great confidence and almost affirmation. People saying, I look out, I see more technology available, more financial resources, just sheer more people working on this agenda now than ever have been. And then they sort of oscillate and say, I've never found it more difficult or challenging to do this work. I feel this great sense of urgency, everything. One of the folks in the room with us said also, you know, relax, ebbs and flows in everything. This is not a straight line. There is something of a down moment, what John Elkington from Volans, our partner in the research, might call a down wave, and that's okay. We've navigated down waves before, and they shake out, you know, some of what's not working.
I think that in the workshop we did, we had a good mix of people who did this for a long time.
Yep.
And had that wisdom of history to say things like that. There's up and down. We've gotten through downturns on sustainability before. And then we also had new people who came in with a different level of energy, who are just, you know, still very enthusiastic, full on, and learning it, and all the excitement of a new thing is there. And we had this nice mix of people from civil society and corporates and some investors. And so it was just that and not a bad sense of diversity of people from different parts of the world or experience in different parts of the world. And so I think it felt like a good, everyone was able to talk about all these different pieces of the elephant. And after the first, that was the first half of our workshop. And they were like, okay, look, we got it all in our system. We've sort of said all these things that people are thinking about or anxious about. And then it moved into the second part, which was like, okay, so where are we going to go from here?
Yeah. And moment before we move on to solutions, but just thinking about the diversity of people in the room with us, a couple more things that stood out to me about that that were so interesting, that we had representatives from the Middle East and Latin America who said, hey, sustainability has never looked better. You know, the momentum that we have on this right now, the investment that is pouring in, you all might be experiencing some kind of a period on a plateau or a bit of backsliding. We are not. We're optimistic and we're moving faster than we've ever had the opportunity before. And we want to see that continue. And then it was also a diversity of types of people. There were a good number of people who would probably call themselves sustainability professionals, if you will. But there were also people from multiple other corporate functions, or as you said, investors in the room. And that's part of what's changed for me in the arc of Climate Week over time, is that something that used to be mostly originally for the sustainability professional community now includes people from every part of organizations. And that's one of the encouraging things to me about what happened here this week, what I heard here this week, is it seems that, you know, people in finance and supply chain, procurement, you know, operational elements of companies, real estate, because of its huge impact, they're all here looking for solutions, everything from, you know, traditional sustainability strategy through to the development and commercialization of products and services that will take more market share because they're better products and services, not because they've been branded as sustainable. What about the solution side, Chris? What was happening there?
And as we've maybe shared before, we did, in designing the research together, find 64 specific actions or initiatives that are in play, either for a while or newly in play. And we tried to be quite inclusive by thinking, what are actions that NGOs or civil society could do? What about government policies they do? What about corporate actions? And also capital markets and investors. And so from that, we built up these 64 different types of actions, quite balanced sense of the agenda. We missed a bunch of stuff, but you know, not bad, 80%, yeah. 80% there. And then we asked stakeholders to rate it on two dimensions: potential impact of 2030, and then the feasibility given the context to deliver on those things. And so you have this, in the room, this beautiful matrix of 64 dots, very complicated, a little chaotic.
Vibrant colors.
Vibrant. Well, and we colored the dots based on each of the, you know, the principal, not the exclusive, but the principal actor for each. So in each quadrant, you had dots that were representative of all the four different types of actors. So,
and the four:
civil society, investors and capital markets, business, and then public policy, governments and policy.
Right. So corporates got to be blue, and I think civil society got to be orange. I can't remember the plot, but you could tell the difference just glancing.
Yeah. And so just when you look at your eyes at this craziness, you can see, wow, okay, so everyone's got a role to play in each part of the quadrant. So if you look at the high impact, high feasibility quadrant, where that would tell us the biggest heat and momentum and probably the prioritization of things going forward, there, all four dot colors were represented. And in some level, it simply tells us that it's not just business, it's not just government, it's not just investors, it's not just civil society, it's everyone's got a role to play to make that ecosystem of change happen. Which I think is quite, it's an obvious thing to say, but I think sometimes in conversations that people do seem to, you know, double down on their thing or their vantage point. You hear it from the business side sometimes, like, it's just a business case. It's all about value creation. That's all that matters. We've got to just do that, like, full stop. And then some governmental policy people are like, no, we've just got to get the policy right. That's what matters. That's, and then NGOs saying, no, we got a collective action. So everyone's right. And that's the, and our secret is finding a way to make most of the best ideas align and reinforce each other. And that's a challenge, right?
Yeah, I like the way you emphasize when you talk about the four different actors, government, private sector, and crew, that you always say each dot, you know, each of the actions was attributed to the one we expect to do most on it, but they don't own it. Everybody's got a part to play. And the other part, I think, is this intersection of how those different actors both need to support one another. So a couple of the conversations or types of conversations that have struck me this week have been around how we get investors to put capital into possibly more sustainable options when the timelines for payback are uncertain. Mm-hmm. So we're still fighting a fundamental short-term, long-term trade-off. And we have to solve the trade-off, right? Mm-hmm. That unless we entirely change the way investment models work and throw out fiduciary duty, investors are going to continue to say, I can see the long-term potential of that in sustainability terms, but if there's no payoff for longer than my other choices, I'm almost obliged to make those other choices. Yeah. But almost more where I wanted to go with this was how the actors need to support one another. And Unilever has released a report this week that is about NDCs, you know, the governmental nationally defined determined contributions. Yeah. That they write up under the Paris Agreement, say, this is our plan to decarbonize. But I love that Unilever, and this is the second in a series, I think they did one previously, on kind of why corporates need to say, please, governments, we need great NDCs. Mm-hmm. And hey, corporate friends, we need to deliver climate transition plans that support these NDCs. And if the NDCs are insufficient and they don't give us the policy frameworks that we need to deliver on our transition plans, then we need to say that to government. And that there's a back and forth there that is really necessary, that we need a policy framework that is enabling, and we need business to support that when it is put in place. So just one of the interplays, yeah, and I think there are many.
That clarity of the prescription of what's needed, and that almost that proactive collaboration that Unilever is trying to do, I think is this next generation of collaboration. Before, we were like, oh, we should get together and talk and we'll throw things out. But to have that intentionality, we need to do this and we need to do this. And then almost bringing people together and those types of organizations that are able to bring and integrate some of those actions, like that's a big leadership. And it's not easy, right? You can get people in a room, then get people to stay in the room, but then get people to go away from the room and do something that's coordinated. It's really messy and hard, but that's what we have to get to.
Yeah. Yeah. And Chris, if I can get you to play out maybe one more thing, and then we can let the survey go and finish on some broader Climate Week observations and learnings and everything else. But what was pushed into the four quadrants of, you know, high impact, highly feasible to low impact, low feasibility, there were some surprises in what fell where, and we obviously can't go through the list of 64, but can you tell us a couple examples of things that were maybe pushed at the edges, really high or really low, and how that struck you?
Yeah, I think the stuff in the top right-hand quadrant, which again, I think means that that's where the heat is, and we probably need to
at least the short term over the next 5 years. Yeah,
we've got some momentum. There were things that relate to creating a market for sustainability. And that came from two sides, because there's business and civil society in that quadrant. One is this just commercializing sustainability. So we're serving customers and consumers in ways that actually, you know, drive more impact. That's good and clear, and it's a big role for business. But the other side was also creating a market just from a cultural and preferential perspective, so that people just want to choose those kinds of things. So I think that's the additive value, I think, of having the different stakeholders involved and framing it the way we did, is that it's again, it's not one or the other, it's both at the same time, and they have to work together. So that was interesting. Innovation is also prevalent in the top right-hand quadrant, from pure just technology solutions to unlocking some of those promises that we've had for a while, like circularity. So that is still quite an abstract thing.
Yeah. You know,
there's, and yet we collectively, the collective wisdom, put circularity there. So a lot of innovation to be done there as well, which is exciting. And straight on activism, political activism, sustainability narratives that are culturally resonant, and advocacy of policy.
And maybe on that specific last one, I think really interesting that while there was the call for ongoing political activism, there was not much support for traditional NGO campaigns. That was one of the things that was seen as, if I have it right, it was highly feasible, but relatively low impact.
Right.
So
yeah.
How do you parse the difference between, yes, this advocacy, no, this other one?
I think the NGO campaigns, I think, are pretty, this is the beauty of this study, and that is why I think it's such a catalytic conversation starter, is that there's lots of interpretation. But I think the specificity of an NGO campaign as a particular tactic has limited appealer value. But if we're looking at activism more broadly, again, it's almost like a collective approach. And how do we connect the dots between what governments are doing and what business are doing and what society wants? So I think there's a bit more intentionality and focus. But you're right. I think and having NGOs in the bottom right hand quadrant on that, their traditional tactical things, and that sense that NGOs are really not living up to their capabilities when it comes to assessing performance. There are a few NGOs in the room that spoke to that. I think this is really a real challenge for that sector. And I think others in the room had some sympathy for needing to find ways to get civil society, and you know, back to the table in a productive way to help with that ecosystem of change.
And that's another way in which it's that this whole spectrum of actors, right? And that if we don't have all of private sector, public sector, civil society, you know, all these actors, partners, the capital markets moving at least roughly in the same direction, that we complicate any possibility of delivery on widespread decarbonization probably too much. You know, it will keep it from being successful.
And I had a conversation with someone from a company that's in the healthcare space, and they were saying that they've been slowly over a long time supporting small local NGOs across the world to help capacitate on some of the health and well-being agenda, which keeps shifting. And they've realized over time, they've got this remarkable constellation and network of people who are doing real stuff on the ground that no one else could do because they're so local and so grassroots in orientation. And at the same time, when they look at it, they've got this remarkable network that could be fused together in a much more collaborative, intentional space. So there's this next generation of innovative thinking that companies are looking at that takes some of the principles we've always known, partnership, collaboration, that's good. But then how do we distinguish between really effective collaboration and mediocre collaboration? And some of those companies and organizations starting to see that difference.
And maybe we all need to try kind of the proverbial walking in one another's shoes, but with real intent. Also, I bumped into the head of Oceanwise while I was here, and their organization that ERM works with and supports to some degree. They do kelp, reforestation in the ocean as a carbon sink. And they also look at innovation around materials and how we can diminish, especially plastics. And like they have basically a laundry lab where they assess, you know, different ways to wash clothes to reduce the microplastics that come off, also alternative materials. So, you know, they're doing technological innovation that then they promote to the clothing and footwear industries and others. So we need to look everywhere for the innovations that might bring us solutions.
And that does feel this like back to the week here, and we'll go to the bottom left-hand quadrant because there's implications, I think, as well. but I think just on the
I was trying to steer you away, but yeah,
we've got our jaws onto it. That what's different here between especially a number of years ago is that you're seeing a lot more technologists and not just the early ideas, but actually things that are kind of getting to a more mature phase and, you know, not scale yet, but something that's in the pipeline that's close. And I was invited to a couple of events with focused on water technology specifically. And so these are fascinating inventions that people are doing of measuring and censoring with great specificity inside. This one organization was doing a public housing, so at scale, and not only identifying remarkable savings of like 60% of flow on water in some cases. And then the infrastructure with water running through pipes also has a net present value deterioration that's really significant. And then saving individuals' utility bills, like that's also meaningful. And it's not just like in one or two, it's happening in cities across the world. So this flourishing of this kind of solutions without being Pollyannish, it's really exciting.
Well, and that's where if we want consumers to, you know, create demand and pull on this, if we can lower their water bill and deliver them fresh, clean, warm when you need it for a shower water, then that's a win. Nobody will even pause to think about that. They'll just ask to be signed up. Even though I've been trying to avoid it, the lower left-hand quadrant was really also interesting. Mm-hmm. This, if you're tracking with us, and I'd appreciate on this podcast, Chris, we're asking everybody to visualize the four quadrants and the 64 things. So that the lower left-hand quadrant was over the next 5 years deemed to be lowest likely to be done or to move significantly, and lowest impact, even if that's where you pressed. And some of the surprises there, or some of the things that were just a little bit hard to see at first, were like the major intergovernmental frameworks. Mm-hmm. So that's where we saw the Paris Agreement. That's where we saw the Kunming-Montreal Biodiversity Convention. That's where we saw the SDGs. Why do you think that happened? And how did the folks in the room with us this week respond? Yeah,
it was nicely contested, because people, especially the Paris Agreement, can't let that go. And I think my interpretation, because again, it's quite subjective and mm-hmm. no one knows fully, but I think on a relative basis, stakeholders have determined that those principles and values and frameworks were really important to get us to where we are today.
Okay.
And we would not be here if we did not have even the SDGs, despite their challenges, and things like the UN Global Compact and B Corp certification. All of those things were really instrumental to kind of get to a stronger foundation and mainstreaming, to a degree, sustainable business and sustainable policymaking. So that was really fundamental. But on a basis of where are we going to get more juice out of the orange? Is it another, you know, is it in these frameworks and voluntary principles and values driven things, or, and they're existing, like these are not necessarily, I think no one's saying we should disband any of these things, but on a relative basis, if we can find ways to commercialize sustainability and create a market for things, maybe that's more important. Carbon mm-hmm. pricing and mechanisms is viewed as a place for more heat and juice to come out of that orange than those lower left-hand quadrants. So I think in all, when you look at the sweep of it, it does tell a story of, we did a bunch of stuff importantly 10 or 15 years ago. It was the right thing to do, I think. And we built these foundations. And like everything, the evolution of the agenda has moved to something that's more innovative oriented, more specific, more complicated and sophisticated. And the task, I think, for all of us is how can we be contributing and facilitating that? And that means we all, again, back to the first points you said, where 9 in 10 stakeholders say, we got to change.
So much change.
We all got to change. And so we need to think of that and be guided by that top right-hand quadrant.
Yeah. You know, really strong agreement with what you ran through, and a couple more sort of pieces to it that I think your 10 to 15 years reference, we did this then. And maybe we got a little too mired in some of them. Like, what we need to do is stand on that foundation and do the next thing, yeah. possible way to think about it. Also, you sort of skirted the edges of this, but you know, the question was not, are these things important?
Right.
And in no way was the survey trying to suggest that they weren't even critical, let alone important steps along the way, and continue to have roles to play. But the question was, which of these things will make the most difference in the next 5 years?
Yeah.
And we, you know, time and resources and ingenuity, and, you know, there's only so much of it at any one given moment. So we got to apply our resources. And yeah, just that nothing being in the bottom quadrant doesn't mean it won't swim out of it over time, and doesn't mean we don't want to deliver on those things still. But that's not where our effort should go. That poor orange has been overjuiced, but we're apparently going to get more juice from other parts of the plot. I guess, you know, as we sit here, think about that session, but Climate Week a bit more broadly, are you leaving with any sense of, you know, what can you do different this next year or two from your perspective, from GlobeScan's perspective?
I think recognition that the tent has gotten bigger. And so, you know, we've been both doing this for a while, so you kind of get a little bit, you know, ossified in mm-hmm. how you see things. And so the tent is bigger, more people are involved from coming from different aspects, and maybe not fully sustainability, like 100% of their time, they're in it, maybe 75% of their time is doing something outside of sustainability, but there's a connection point that, so how do we connect to those other networks and integrate more fully? I think that's a conceptually something we have to do. I am really worried about the NGO side of things. And I'll tell you an anecdote, because I went to, on Sunday was Sun Day.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
The Earth Day redo. And Bill McKibben, I guess, was the, I think the architect behind it, wanted to launch the Sunday. And I was all excited, going to come to, you know, Climate Week a day early and go and see it and see him speak, which was interesting. Mm-hmm. But the turnout was, I was expecting, I don't know, Mike, because the original Earth Day in 1970 was 20 million people came out. So the biggest protest in U.S. history and maybe in history of other nations. This was a relatively, you know, number 100 people.
Wow.
And the conversation was interesting. It's all around using solar power and the power of the energy transition and how simple but effective and impactful that is, which is a wonderful story. And then I went out to the little protest across the to see, and it was very underwhelming, you know, and especially the fact that there weren't many young people.
Ah, interesting.
And I think if you look at the, you know, other movements in society, particularly more on the right, there's a lot of youthful energy. And so that was like, wow, okay, so this is maybe why we're collectively seeing civil society from a sustainability perspective needs something different and needs to change. And
Chris, it needs juice.
Yeah.
Needs more juice. No, little anecdote. I find Bill McKibben so interesting. And honestly, some of his writings were what was most inspiring to me early in my career. Like it helped me think I want to do this. And yes, his voice has been, and I think still is, remarkable, but you're saying it's not being responded to in the same way. And that's important. And most, you know, campaigns in general, you did sort of think of protests against conflicts, you know, classic Vietnam War in this country, you know, these were young people out protesting. Mm. And I think we have to stop and question anytime there's not a strong youth cohort in a campaign movement, then is it, if the next generation isn't engaged, it almost by definition can't last. Yeah. So need some more energy there. But yeah, really interesting that was the kickoff to Climate Week for you and what it fed into after that.
Yeah, it wasn't what I was expecting, something very different. But what about you? What was anything that stood out as being particularly relevant? Or
yeah, I mean, almost to a point of it being automatic, and I don't mean to diminish it, that the language of quantification, financial value, business value was everywhere. Mm-hmm. I think that's partly because Climate Week assembles different people. And if you're going to put investors and policymakers and business and, you know, stakeholders in a room together, they're going to have to boil down to a, how does this create value for everyone? But also, how do we articulate it? I think there's much more emphasis right now on, if we can't articulate the financial value that this sustainability effort delivers to us as an organization, then we won't be able to sustain it. And people will say that's not reasonable, that there's a moral case here, that there's, and all of that is true. But I think the question comes down to, what can we ask the private sector to do as companies in this case, for, you know, my takeaway. Yeah. And what I see is being really positive in that is that there's a forcing function there about simplifying, that this field has talked forever about materiality and how to do it. And it almost feels like it's gotten constantly more complicated and there are more issues on the list. Mm. And yet, don't we need to concentrate our resources, human, financial, all of them, on the things where we can really make the most difference? Yeah. And that's how I hear that financial value focus coming through now is, which of these things can we actually make work? Which few things can our organization actually make work? Who do we need to collaborate with to make more of them work? And I heard a beautiful interpretation of this at one event today, which was separating the complexity of the social and the need to do more collaboration, both in sector and multi-sector, to solve big social issues, and more ability to drive certain environmental issues and others on their own. So there's that parsing, like, we can do this. This is where we need partners. This is where we need a different kind of investor, but just more rigorous thought, full stop. Mm. I think the sustainability community benefits from that. And people were putting kind of more pressure on themselves this week, I think, to deliver. There's a sense of urgency. They want to spend their time where they think it will have the most impact.
And I saw that too and agree. And I do think that there is also, again, because collectively people to see whatever we're doing now isn't working exactly right. So therefore, what's the new ideas and open to new perspectives, I think rethinking these things, and I think just trying stuff, which is, you know, sometimes marred in a sense of, oh, just being pragmatic, but I think it is also just like experimentation that's happening. And it felt like there's, because we've always had for the last 5 or 6 years, lots of rumblings about, you know, disclosure and too much compliance, and we're, you know, box ticking, and we're gathering data rather than doing. And I think that feels like that corner, we've turned a corner on that, where it's less about that. Either the systems are in place and people have done it once and it's less of a preoccupation and a heavy lift, or this thirst for innovation and new ideas and new approaches. So it does feel like a fresh beginning of the next wave or era of all this stuff. And again, that unsurprising amount of optimism in rooms, you know, despite some of the big macro trends, very encouraging.
Yeah, I think that's not a bad place to maybe end today's conversation, to end on that up note, which I feel as well. It also kind of reflects the mid-decade 2025. It's almost like we need that springboard, You know, tying it again to Crossroads one last time. That's kind of why we did the survey now. We wanted to look at how to accelerate the agenda over the next years. And you'll probably hear more from us about plans to follow that Crossroads research, emphasizing the solutions, studying more which of them might work best in different regions. And we hope that will be one of the ways that we can contribute to knocking all this forward to everyone's benefit. So, Chris, as you said, it's been so nice to sit here and do this in person this time. David, we missed having you here with us, but we'll maybe get some of your observations on Climate Week and pointing ahead on the path to COP30 when we're next all together. And to all of you who chose to listen today, thank you so much. If you're interested in other episodes of the All in Sustainable Business podcast, they're all online on your favorite platform of choice. There's also a LinkedIn you can follow to know when the next podcasts are coming. And we're always incredibly open to any feedback. Thank you so much. And thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Mark. Take care, everybody.